This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a unique multimedia concert with a progressive string quartet, a gala celebration that harkens back to the 1920s, or a world premiere of a ballet inspired by an Italian opera, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The Contemporary Art Center's Art for Art's Sake kicks off this Saturday with gallery openings at the CAC and throughout the Arts District. The evening before this fall art celebration, the CAC is kicking off its new season with Ethel. The Progressive String Quartet will perform Ethel's Documerica, a unique experience blending vintage photos of America with a wide range of original music. Joining me by phone is violist Ralph Farris. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Hi there. Great to be with you.
And welcome to New Orleans. Is this your first trip to the city?
This is my very first trip and Ethel's first trip as an ensemble. I can't believe I've never been. I know I'm going to love it.
Well, we're happy to have you here. Tell us about what you are exploring in this multimedia concert.
The program is called Documerica, Ethel's Documerica. It's based on and inspired by an EPA project from the 70s. By the same name, Documerica. The project was one of the first big things to get off the ground when the EPA was founded, and what they did was they sent photographers all across the land to shoot and document the state of things, not just how the trees and rivers and valleys were looking, but actually the people and the real general environment and way of living in America at that time. You see this incredible imagery of folks celebrating in streets and having difficulties on gas lines and dancing and airplanes landing and people swimming and gorgeous underwater shots and just amazing total overview of the United States in the 70s. And this archive recently was digitized, and we were deeply inspired by all the amazing colors and the imagery and the snapshots of life that it was giving us as Americans. And we were really keen to do something with this archive. So we went about the process of connecting with a designer, an amazing projection designer named Deborah Johnson, and she built this whole show with director Steve Cawson of multimedia reimaginations of all these photographs. So as that was going on simultaneously, we commissioned four amazing composers, dear friends of ours, Mary Ellen Childs, who's based in Minneapolis. She works a lot with percussion and dancers, and she's got a real beautiful sort of folk connection to the American experience as seen through the eyes of a real gentle and compassionate spirit. Then we have James Kimo Williams, who is a founding music director, I believe, of the Lieutenant Dan Band, which may be a group that New Orleans is familiar with. Kimo is also a Vietnam vet himself, which is how he originally, I believe, met Gary Sinise. Through his activism, Gary Sinise and he connected. Kimo wrote for us as well. And then we had, in addition, Chickasaw Nation composer in residence, Jared Impichacha Tate. I believe the Chickasaw Nation original homeland is in the Mississippi Delta. And then finally, we have Ulysses Owens Jr., who is an awesome jazz drummer and one of the first graduates of the Juilliard Jazz Program. Ulysses comes from a background of Southern gospel music and jazz. In addition, the four Ethels also brought our own music. The result is about a 75-minute through-running event. It is at once sort of like going to a gorgeous film with live music. There's certainly no words involved, and it's a completely encompassing event. You have an opportunity to sit in a space of meditation with some really stunning photographs that are challenging and also quite hopeful in so many ways. And then it's all accompanied with some fabulous music that runs the gamut from intense driving Latin-inspired grooves to gorgeous hymnody to music inspired from Native American traditions, a Hopi buffalo song. Really an awesome, intimate experience.
Now, who are the members of Ethel?
The two founding artistic directors, that's Dorothy Lawson and me. We've been at this pushing 18 years. Dorothy is the cellist, I'm the violist. We have Kip Jones on violin, and our newest member who joined us in January, Corin Lee.
Are you based in New York?
We are based in New York, yes. New York City Band.
And the name Ethel, does it mean something?
The name means nothing. I love that. Normally we get the question, how did you get the name? It came from the film Shakespeare in Love. You may recall that the bard was writing a play in that film called Romeo and Ethel, the pirate's daughter. And he was suffering from writer's block because what a silly title. And one of our other founding members, our original member, Mary Rowell, she had just seen that film, and we were trying to name ourselves. And Mary started chuckling when she was remembering this film, and she said, well, what about Ethel? The big thing that we really wanted to do was just leave our possibilities open with our name. When you start calling somebody a string quartet, there's immediately a supposition of what your work is going to be, what you need to look like, what you need to sound like, the style of music that you play. And there's just a lot of limitations and expectations built into what it means to be a string quartet. What we really wanted to do was just have a grand old time playing music and making music with other people. And the fact that we played these string instruments was actually incidental in a lot of ways. We're not limited by what we call ourselves. We're just Ethel.
Will there be works that are recognizable to us?
People are going to have this visual stimulation that will remind them of a moment. There might be a picture or a face or an idea. The images of the ladies quilting is going to bring several people back. It always brings me back, and I wasn't even there. But as to the music, there are a couple quotes. The Herbie Hancock and the Motown quotes you would probably recognize in Dorothy's music. Jared's use of the Hopi Buffalo song, you wouldn't necessarily know it, but you feel like you know it because it feels very much part of the American tapestry. Ulysses' music, he's got a song called Revival Crusade, which just is a straight-ahead gospel tune, and you feel like you're at a revival when you're listening to it. The styles are going to evoke ideas that folks can recognize and feel really comfortable with, but they wouldn't necessarily hear like a melodic element that is familiar to them. It's just a sense of being in this space and these times and these colors that will make sense and in a lot of ways, I think, be very, very comforting.
Wow, this sounds like quite a journey.
We're going to have foot-stomping good time.
Ethel violist Ralph Farris, looking forward to seeing you in New Orleans.
Thank you so much. We cannot wait to get to see you all and play for you.
The Contemporary Arts Center presents Ethel's Documerica Friday evening at 7:30, 900 Camp Street. More info online at cacno.org. An iconic family-owned French Quarter restaurant, the oldest in the country, Antoine's, is wrapping up its year-long 175th anniversary celebration. This week, a Prohibition-themed gala takes us back in time to the 1920s. It's one of several events planned to conclude the historic anniversary. Joining me now to talk about the art of the cocktail during forbidden times is Antoine's Lisa Blunt. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's begin, Lisa, with a little history on the restaurant's beginning back in 1840.
So the restaurant began in 1840 when Antoine Alciator, as a young chef from Marseille, France, decided to spread his wings and come to the U.S. From the history that we have with him, we figure he did come from Paris and went into New York. We know he stayed in New York a little bit. We don't know how long. We think that he may have wanted to stay there, but then people said, hey, you should maybe go to New Orleans. You speak French. And at the time, it was the second largest port. And so he went there. Important part about that was he met a woman on the boat and fell in love with her and said, you know, I'm going to call for you when I'm all settled in New Orleans. And so he got to New Orleans, obviously opened the pension, which is now Antoine's, and he did call for her, and her name was Julie Fry. And why I mention that is just that after he died, she did take over. She took over for many, many years. She actually lived to be 91. So we still have pictures of her and things like that in the early 1900s.
If the plates in the restaurant's dozen or so dining rooms could speak, what story would stand out?
Oh, you know, I think it stands out in different ways through different eras. I think what was interesting when Antoine came to New Orleans, you know, here he was a trained chef, but he didn't have all the ingredients he had in France. But he came to a place of such bounty of food and seafood. And so I think in those days, people were probably eating that food and saying, wow, these are really cool, incredible sauces. And the way he's cooking things is really incredible because most things were boiled. They were put into a pot. There wasn't chefs. So I think in that era, there there was that, wow, I'd never tasted food like that. I think into the next era with Antoine's is when his son took over Jules, who was a real bon vivant guy, big ego guy. We joke, his pictures in the 1840 room, he's got two pictures up. He was a party guy, and he really brought celeb to it. So the plates then, I think, would have been saying, wow, this is the best party in town. This is wonderful food. This is innovative food. This is the man who invented oysters Rockefeller. So we say he brought the party to Antoine's. Then in the next generation, when his son took over in the early 30s, Roy Alciator, Roy was a much more detail-oriented man. You would have called him a computer geek, probably, but a very intelligent and a very humble, likable man. And he really brought the fine dining to Antoine's and the white tablecloth. So I think in those times, the plates would have been saying, wow, this is so meticulous and this is so perfectly done. And what a grand experience in those eras. And as we've evolved now into the times of more current, I think what people do when they come now is they see it as they're eating these traditions, which is so cool. I mean, there's menu items that haven't changed for 100 years, but they may look a little bit different. They may be on a plate that's a little bit more stylized. And some of the specials we run are things that are influenced by the original things, but again, are some more interesting things of the cuisine of today, but still influenced by Antoine.
Why did you pick the Prohibition era when the sale of alcohol was forbidden for your anniversary celebration?
We really wanted it to be a big cocktail party, and so it naturally kind of flowed into what was a fun time in the restaurant's era, Prohibition. We have a very famous room in the Mystery Room that was a speakeasy during Prohibition. Fun story of that you had to enter through the women's restroom to get into the speakeasy. Then you were poured your whiskey or your alcohol in there in a coffee cup. And then you'd go back out, and people would say, where'd you get that? And they'd say, it's a mystery. And Roy Alciator at the time thought, the feds are never going to go into the women's restroom. So that kind of spurned it, and we're going to actually take the Mystery Room that night and decorate it, bringing in whiskey barrels like it was a speakeasy.
So you got around the blue laws via the ladies' room?
Yes, exactly.
So as you celebrate the Prohibition era, tell me, what's going to be on tap for revelers?
You know, all sins happened during Prohibition. So we're going to have drinking and music and gambling. We're also going to have a champagne parlor. And there is also a secret room. You'll find out how to enter the secret room. It's replicating something from the era, and it'll be a lot of fun.
Is it the ladies' room?
It is not the ladies' room. And it is not the men's room, because that's been asked before to me. It's like, what's the secret room going to be?
And you won't reveal the secret, will you?
Nope, but I'm not revealing the secret.
Now, you mentioned that there would be gambling, gangster gambling. Is this faux gambling?
This is faux gambling. If you've never learned how to play roulette, if you've never learned how to play craps, or you just want to, you know, button up your skills a little bit, you can do that with some fun money.
Are there going to be Prohibition-inspired cocktails?
The biggest thing during Prohibition was really whiskey. Mm-hmm. So whiskey will be served in a variety of different things. Whiskey and bourbon, our famous Sazerac, of course, will be served as a favorite. There will be some rum drinks. Rum was also pretty big coming out of the Caribbean. The other thing that was really large during Prohibition was champagne.
Now, Antoine's is being run by a fifth generation today. What do you see in the restaurant's future?
Well, right now, the fifth generation, who is my husband, he's still active in it. There's quite a few family members.
This is Rick Blunt?
Yep. This is Rick Blunt. And I think we're going to still be involved in it for a while. There's 13 grandchildren. Some of them have shown some interest. We'll see what happens in moving on.
The gala celebrates Antoine's 175th anniversary, but another historic staple in the French Quarter will benefit from the festivities.
Yes, the Historic New Orleans Collection, which we have a very special relationship with. If people walk into some of the rooms like the Rex Room or the Hermes Bar, we actually have artifacts in there from those crews, and they're actually on loan from the Historic Collection. They've come in and taken some of our goodies and things, and we've given them to them. And they most importantly have so kept our history.
Today, Antoine's takes up nearly an entire city block. To what do you attribute the restaurant's longevity?
I think it really has been sticking to what we do best, French Creole classic cuisine.
Another big event this week is a block party.
Oh, yes.
Is that on the same night or a different night?
It's actually the night before. So the gala is on October 3rd, and then the block party is on October 2nd. So that's going to be from 5 to 7. We have the whole block between Royal and Bourbon. St. Louis is closed down during those couple of hours. Come by and have a drink and enjoy the fun. There's also going to be a live band, too.
Lisa Blunt with Antoine's Restaurant. Here's to another 175 years.
Thank you.
More info is online at antoines.com. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. The Marigny Opera House opens a new season with its world premiere of Orfeo. This adaptation for ballet was inspired by Monteverdi's Baroque opera. Joining me now to talk about this contemporary ballet is Marigny Opera House Executive Director Dave Herbert. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
And congratulations on your second season.
Yes, indeed.
What are your thoughts as you enter the new season?
I'm happy we have a second season. We had permitting problems last winter, and they've all been resolved. And in fact, we've improved the church, the building itself. We have added a beautiful new entrance, which is handicap accessible. We have installed a state-of-the-art fire detection system. We have repaired all of the plaster on the church's ceiling and all of its walls. We're in a much better venue. Aside from the building, we're very happy to continue with the second season of the Marigny Opera Ballet. And we're attempting something that's not frequently done these days, a full-length narrative contemporary ballet.
Now, this ballet has been in the planning, from what I understand, for a while now.
It has been. I have always wanted to do a production of Monteverdi's Orfeo, and I've been thinking about it for the past several years. I even attempted a translation of the libretto. The requirements for that opera are too great for the Marigny Opera House stage. Simply too many people. Full chorus, soloist, full orchestra. Our stage would be so crowded there'd be almost no dancing. We'd be lucky if people could shift a little bit to the right or the left. Once we started the Marigny Opera Ballet, I realized that perhaps we could present Orfeo as a story narrative ballet. And so I began to work on streamlining the opera libretto. We had to lose some scenes, some characters. We only have 8 dancers. We had to lose the chorus. And at the end of the day, we decided that we needed new music. The Monteverdi opera, without the singers, we felt wouldn't be the best music for a dance company. Fortunately, we're very familiar with Tucker Fuller, the local composer who worked on several productions at the Marigny Opera House, including the Bacchae, his Salve Regina, which won a Gambit Award. So I asked Tucker if he could create a full-length ballet score. Tucker was a little bit flummoxed at first. He said he'd never written a full-length ballet, which isn't unusual. So he began a study of the great Stravinsky and Tchaikovsky ballets and came up in collaboration with Maya Taylor, the choreographer, with my co-director Spencer Doyle and myself, and our conductor, Francis Scully, a full-length, 2-act, 1-hour ballet. The music is spectacular. It begins in the fields of Thrace for a very happy wedding, and it ends deep in the underworld for a rather sad ending.
This is based on the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice.
Yes. Part of the myth, the scenario for the ballet, is based on the libretto from 1609, and the parts of the story that we've used are where the main action events occur. Those are suitable for dancing. It begins with Orfeo, who has the power of enchantment over all living things, animals, people, gods, goddesses.
And this is through music?
Through music, through his singing, and especially through his magic lyre or harp. The tragedy here is Orfeo is a demigod. He's neither god nor human nor mortal, and so he doesn't really fit in anywhere. He can't connect with any other human or godlike creatures. He attracts them. Everyone falls in love with him. But because he's neither at home on earth or in heaven or the underworld, he's fated always to be alone. In this legend, he finds love with a mortal, Eurydice. But of course, fated to always be alone, he loses her. She dies on their wedding day. Orfeo, being a demigod, follows her. He tricks his way into the underworld, to the land of the shades, to bring her back. Pluto, the king of the underworld, and his queen, Proserpina, are struck by his love for Eurydice, and they allow him to take her away, back to the land of the living, on one condition. Orfeo cannot look back. He cannot look back at the underworld. He cannot look back at Eurydice. They begin their process back to the land of the living, and just before they reach the sunlight, Orfeo cannot resist. He has to make sure that she's behind him, and he looks. And with that look, everything is lost. Eurydice is dragged back, Orfeo emerges, the sun rises, and he's alone.
It reminds me of the biblical story of Lot's wife.
Yes, Lot's wife looked back, and she turned into a pillar of salt. Orfeo looked back and loses his love. The legend itself, I think about a lot. It's quite profound. On the surface, it's about love and the loss of love. But I think it's also about the human condition, how we are all basically alone, and how love is the only connection we can hope to make, true connection with life. And failing that, we are alone.
How are you hoping to make a connection with today's audiences?
Tucker's music, the new score, is contemporary. It's eclectic. He uses dance rhythms from today. He uses all kinds of influences, and the music is highly accessible and very beautiful. Maya Taylor's choreography is contemporary. This is not an academic classical ballet. It's highly athletic. I think it has more in common with Alvin Ailey or Paul Taylor than it would with George Balanchine, or the academic or classical ballet one would see at a Nutcracker performance. The dancing itself is quite exciting. We have 8 marvelous dancers. Orfeo is being portrayed by Trey Maldwin, who's in his second season with the Marigny Opera Ballet. Eurydice is danced by Anna Iosipif, also in her second season. There are 3 other main characters. One is the serpent, played by Donovan Davis, who's double cast. In the second act, Donovan portrays Pluto, the king of the underworld. And Kellis Oldenburg will dance his wife, Proserpina. The other roles in the ballet include animals. We have a lion and a ram who are enchanted by Orfeo and his harp. We have attendants of Eurydice. In the second act, in the land of the shades, we have spirits of the departed performed by other cast members. Like any ballet, this is a collaboration of all of us. And I think the result, our full-length Orfeo, is going to make people happy. In spite of it being a very sad story in the end, I hope it will inspire people.
Dave Herbert, Executive Director of the Marigny Opera House. Thanks.
Thank you.
The Marigny Opera House presents Orfeo, with performances Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 8 p.m. More info at marinyoperahouse.org. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.